Christopher Gabriel.
When you hear owners say, well, you know, we're just not sure that we're ready to give up a preseason game because we're going to lose money. You're not going to lose money. You're going to make a...
Christopher Gabriel program, you are cleared for departure. Have a good flight.
The Christopher Gabriel program begins now.
Your 50,000 watt sports leader in Fresno, the Central Valley, and for, well, my voice is changing, and for listeners who wear buzzers trying to tip off other listeners as to what we're going to be talking about in the next segment. We want to be just like baseball. 940 ESPN, 940 ESPN Fresno.com. Your 2-hour voice changing tour begins right now. 5 minutes. 31 seconds past the hour of 7 a.m. Pacific Standard Time. I'm the host of the program, Christopher Gabriel. Good morning to you. You know, right before we went on, you ever know you're going into a meeting or you're getting ready for a phone call or a conference call, and then you have a sneezing fit, and you get 3, 7, 10, 12 in a row, and then it's affecting everything from the neck up. That happened just before we jumped on here, and I knew that something was going to happen. It was going to be an unscheduled sneeze, because I try to schedule them during the course of the program. I try to put them in breaks. It doesn't always work that way, and it ended up coming out in the voice. So I apologize for that. That's a $5 CGP fine. Producer of the program not sneezing, at least to my knowledge. Gonzo, good morning to you.
Good morning. So we're back to $5. You had a tendency with 10 across the board for a little bit.
Well, yeah, there is a structure, and I would like to think that you've actually researched that, because it's at your desk, actually, on the left side of your cubicle. The lowest fine that you can get here is a $5 fine. It is the sneezing before the program fine.
Ah, okay.
But we have the $10, we have the $20. Nobody has hit the $30 fines yet, and there is $150, which you'll know it when you hit it.
Hopefully I don't. Yeah. I don't hit it.
Yeah, that's reserved for very special moments. Very special moments. All right. I was on New York Radio 104.1 this morning talking football. And that's a fun group over there, the Drew Show. We don't want you turning from us, but we want you to pay attention to them as well, because it's a great group over there. But Drew and Failiot, they can't decide if they want to call him Failiot or Elliot at this point. But Drew's been on this program before talking esports. And fun group. Have you had a chance to listen to them yet?
I have. Okay. I have had a chance.
Yeah, and I say that because Drew and Failiot are going to be joining me. We have our big Super Bowl roundtable in a couple weeks. We'll get Hammer in here, and we'll get the boys over there. And see, maybe we'll just get the whole building in here.
That's going to be my first Super Bowl roundtable.
Yes, it will. It will, unless you get a $30 or $50 fine, and then you won't be here.
I got to look at that paper.
you really do. No, it'll be fun. We have a fun time with that, and it's... it's a little different from a lot of Super Bowl roundtables. We're not necessarily looking to break down every stat. We're just looking to have basically general mayhem in here, along with making some picks. You want to weigh in during the program, you can do that, 844-940-3776. I hope you're following me on Twitter. For those of you who don't, I know who you are. You can tweet me anytime at CG Program. I say this now because I feel like I need to. I got an email saying, I looked up CG Program, the letter C, the letter G, Program, the word CG Program. It's very easy. It really is. You can follow Gonzo at
JLGonzo21.
Correct. The podcast of this program. It's called the Christopher Gabriel Program. The podcast goes by the same name. You can find every minute, for better or for worse, of this program on 940ESPNFresno.com. We'd like you to go there. Go there right now, as a matter of fact. See the podcast tab and do what?
Hover.
Hover, baby. You got to hover. You hover over, you get the drop down, and it's very nice. You can check out whatever you want. My program, Tony's, whatever you are inclined to look at, it's right there for you. You can email me, cgp@940espnfresno.com. On the program today, bottom of the hour, we're talking some boxing and a little MMA as well. Derek X is in the building. You always know when he's in the building because, you know, the big entourage of vehicles drive up, and, you know, they got the fluorescent lights under the trucks and the cars and stuff, and they're bouncing down Fulton. It's a very cool procession. And then he comes in. He has, like, the advance team that comes in, 10, 12 people, just sort of scrubbing and cleaning the area. And then the big man walks in. Got the hat on. He's got, you know, he looking sharp. We're going to talk a little bit. We're going to talk a little Philly today. We're also going to talk a little bit, as I said, a little bit of MMA, which I got an email about that earlier this week. And so I you know, you ask and we deliver. Tony Landry, Friday picks, 8:05. We've got basically two games. We've got the AFC and the NFC championship games this week. We decided to skip college basketball because there really weren't any games. But the best game this weekend is probably Duke-Louisville. We will give you the best breakdown that you will hear on radio for the AFC and NFC championship games, and Nick Shager at 8:35. One more thing at 8:55. Well, there was a Joe Burrow. You know, there's already been talk about, you know, where is Joe Burrow going to land? Well, it's pretty obvious. He's going to be the first player taken in the draft, and that would mean that he would go to the Cincinnati Bengals. And I always enjoy hearing and reading all the discussion about whoever the first player in the draft is going to be, and we only talk about this relative to when it's a quarterback. We don't talk about it when it's a defensive lineman or a defensive end or a linebacker or a DB. We don't, only when it's a quarterback, and then we start framing it in the way of, well, is he going to have any reservations about playing for them? And I don't know why we do this all the time, because we forget that most of these young men are 21 or 22 years old, and they are as prolific as they are. Of course, it's as good as he gets with Joe Burrow as Heisman Trophy winner, national champion, rewriting record books all year long. But these guys are genuinely thrilled just for the chance to get drafted, and we tend to we layer our own opinions about teams on what these young men are or aren't thinking, and it's usually what they aren't thinking. His dad went on a Canadian radio station and said, and I'm quoting, he's excited to even be in the conversation, and if the Bengals draft him, he's going to be happy. And I mean, listen, we look at the Bengals now, and we make that statement. Will he be happy with the Bengals? Well, he would be going to his home state. I mean, I know that he's adopted Louisiana, and they've adopted him, but he would be going to his home state. I don't know if he was a Browns fan growing up or if he was a Bengals fan. I think that Cincinnati is closer to where he grew up. I may be wrong. He grew up in he's originally from, I believe, Ames, Iowa, but he grew up in Athens or near Athens. The Plains is the city that he's from. But we think about the Cincinnati Bengals, and we think about it, this sort of sad sack franchise that can't do anything right, and they're not always sold out. And, you know, Andy Dalton and you know, the days of Chad Johnson and Ocho Cinco and the crazy uniforms with the orange stripes and just, you know, one thing after another. Even though this is a pretty proud franchise, they go back, you know, a lot of years, and we cast them out like the ugly duckling because they haven't been any good. And it's easy to think back. In NFL history, you look at franchises that were garbage, that just or just never did anything, and then they got one player, they got one quarterback, they got a running back, they got a wide receiver, they got a couple of players over the course of a couple of drafts, and suddenly they became somebody. You know, the New England Patriots, I mean, we now they are the gold standard of the National Football League, you know, having won 6 Super Bowls. And yet, when Bill Belichick arrived, they were an 8-8 team, or they were basically a 500 team. When they took Tom Brady, first of all, nobody really thought much about it. I mean, he had one great national appearance, and that was in the Orange Bowl against Alabama. But nobody really thought much about the Patriots. Nobody really cared. And we do that with a number of different teams. And I think, Gonzo, that the way the whole paradigm should get switched is assuming that the Bengals draft him and that he goes there and they work everything out. If I'm him, if him more than other players recently, he's a guy who wanted to play for Nebraska because of family members who played there. Nebraska had no interest in him. He the hometown school, he sat on the bench against Ohio State. So he's a guy that had a considerable chip on his shoulder, but he wasn't the usual chip on the shoulder player. He's a guy with unbelievable talent, and we saw what that system that the LSU Tigers had that allowed his skills to come to the forefront. And I think that we need to change the paradigm to say, if a guy like Joe Burrow goes to the Bengals, maybe, hopefully, the franchise turns around and suddenly that's one more great team sooner or later down the road a couple of years to watch as a team that is exciting and really a competitive team versus just an also-ran.
Yeah, this would be a really good story, right? If Joe Burrow gets picked number one overall, especially we know his story now, the background of it. But going forward, being able to kind of do it in your home state, just like LeBron, right? LeBron in the NBA always wanted to do it for the Cleveland Cavaliers. He was able to get that done finally. You look at Joe Burrow, and again, this franchise, like I grew up seeing the Cincinnati Bengals be maybe like a playoff team, not too great, not too bad. Recently, of course, they have been bad. But you look at that and you kind of think Joe Burrow for Cincinnati kind of matches. Like it feels like it goes and it fits really well.
Yeah, and you look at the draft order and it's the Bengals, Redskins, Lions, Giants, Dolphins in the top five, in your first five. The Bengals need a quarterback. The Redskins do not, even though it seems like the Redskins take one every year or make a deal for one, does it not?
Yeah, it really does.
You have the Lions, and the you know they've got Matthew Stafford. I don't think he's going anywhere. The Giants have their Daniel Jones. Miami might be the team that's in play to try to do something to go after a guy like Burrow. And, of course, the Chargers are sitting there at six. But it's never a guarantee, but I do think, much like Arizona, when they had Josh Rosen and there was initially all this debate about, well, they've got a guy who was a top 10 draft choice. Why would they take Kyler Murray? Even though Cliff Kingsbury made it clear in college, if I'm on an NFL team, I'm taking him number one. And as you know, when we had Tim Kuehn on the program from ESPN saying that a team, in this case, it was Arizona, didn't want to be the team that passed on a guy like Kyler Murray, and 5 years from now we're saying we had the number one pick. How could we let that guy go? And the position in the National Football League is changing a little bit. It's changing to be more like the Lamar Jacksons. Patrick Mahomes doesn't really want to run, but he can run. He certainly can. Deshaun Watson, certainly. Kyler Murray, very much that kind of player. Joe Burrow is not a guy that wants to run, but has speed and has an elusive quality. He showed certainly that he can run. And I think if you're the Bengals and you're trying to sell tickets, number one, you're trying to excite the fan base, they're in the same position that the Arizona Cardinals were in. This would be this. If I'm a Bengals fan, I'm furious that if they don't take Joe Burrow.
Yeah, I'd be irate if in that situation. Yeah, Joe Burrow, I didn't know he had that sneaky speed. I don't think he's fast, but I saw him in the national championship and I really paid attention to him. And I'm like, this dude can like get out of the pocket and get out of there and go if he needs to. You look at that, and if you're the Cincinnati Bengals, there's no way you can't pick Joe Burrow with the number one overall pick. You haven't had a stable quarterback other than Andy Dalton, but Andy Dalton has been pretty average and slightly above sometimes. But I don't see a situation that they can sell their fan base and say, no, we got to go in a different direction.
No, I completely agree with that. Coming up, one more quarterback has transferred out of Clemson. And it's interesting because when you are at that level and as Nick Saban has said you can never have enough quarterbacks because guys are going to transfer, guys are going to get injured. We've seen that happen, obviously, at Alabama. But there's a unique twist to the Clemson player who has transferred and how most fans around the country don't know his name, will never know his name, but he saved a national championship for Clemson. That's up next. This is the CGP.
You're listening to the Christopher Gabriel Program on 940 ESPN. Christopher Gabriel returns.
It's Retro Bumper Friday. Very familiar, outstanding voice of Dave Matthews. He is our in-house artist today. Dave, not too demanding, just hanging out. He's at the Omelet Bar. Somebody said to us last week, I didn't understand a choice because they think Retro Bumper Friday, it's got to be somebody way back. And that's just what we call it. And we try to bring, you know, artists from different eras, but it can be somebody current as well. Dave Matthews, I think more of his huge work came 10, 15, 20 years ago, but he's still out there touring. He still sounds great. The band sounds fantastic. You probably don't know the name of Chase Bryce. You ever heard of Chase Bryce, Gonzo?
Because I work in this industry, yes.
Okay. You ever heard of Chase Bryce, Gonzo?
No.
Okay. It's a $10 fine. No, but of course you know who it is. So he is the backup quarterback at Clemson, and they've had some guys leave the program because of Trevor Lawrence and his arrival. And usually when a quarterback leaves or a player leaves, but it's the quarterbacks that we tend to focus our energies on. We just think, okay, well, he's not starting, and so he wants to get a chance to play. And at Clemson, not only because of Trevor Lawrence, who is already he's not the penciled in starter, it's the Sharpie. I mean, he's Sharpied in for the starting job next year before he goes to the NFL. And then they signed a five-star quarterback, DJ Uiagalelei, in the 2020 class. Their 2020 class is ridiculous coming in. But Chase Bryce has decided to leave the program. And he was a three-star prospect in their 2017 recruiting class. He was a four-year starter for Grayson High School in Georgia. Think about some of the quarterbacks that have come out of Georgia in the last few years. Trevor Lawrence, Deshaun Watson, Jake Fromm, another young man who's a five-star recruit, Harrison Bailey, rated the number two pro-style quarterback, but it's got great legs. He was fourth all time in the state of Georgia. And Chase Bryce, you put him in there as well. But Chase Bryce is leaving. And Chase Bryce, if you're a Clemson fan, you know that he's somebody who was beloved in their locker room. And the fan base loved him. But they loved him for a lot of reasons. You know, off the field, good guy, community guy. But there was one other reason that they loved him. And I just happened to be watching the game because I didn't know who he was at the time. But Trevor Lawrence got knocked out. He got knocked. They were playing Syracuse, and you know, Syracuse had beaten Clemson the year before up at the Carrier Dome. And Syracuse had a two-touchdown lead on Clemson, and it looked like their national championship run in 2018 was going to get derailed. So he gets knocked out with a concussion. Kelly Bryant, earlier that week, who was the starter for Clemson, he decided that he was transferring. Of course, he ended up going to Missouri. So Dabo Swinney said, I guess we have to go to Chase Bryce. And so they went to Chase Bryce. And Chase Bryce, all Chase Bryce did was come in and not only lead Clemson to rally back and win the game, but the drive that he led them on to ultimately win the game was a 94-yard drive. And without that 94-yard drive, Clemson doesn't ever find their way to Levi's Stadium last January to take on Alabama and pound Alabama 44-16. Bryce was someone who I look back at some of the things that Dabo Swinney was saying on Media Day that day at the SAP Center, and I remember him talking about Bryce, and I remember thinking, because I had seen that game, and just said, wow, okay, yeah, good for Dabo acknowledging a guy that you know we're not here today if it's not for one player who brought us back, and most notably on one key drive. And I think you look at quarterbacks now, Gonzo, and you look at the transfer portal, and I think more and more, I agree with Marty when Marty Lenz, when he's comes on with us on Wednesdays, that I wish the NCAA would consider doing what amounts to a one-off, allowing every player to do one transfer, no questions asked, no waiver, no worries about waivers or anything, because as Marty and I discussed on Wednesday, you're not going to suddenly have 1,200 players looking to find a new school. Most players are happy where they are. Most players going through the recruiting process are comfortable with the decision they made. Most guys have that competitive fire in them that if they're not the starter, they understand that they still have to fight and try to win a job. And leaving one program for another does not guarantee that you're going to be a starter. I mean, look at Kate Martell, who went down to Miami, it didn't work out. He's there. It didn't work out for him to be the starting quarterback. In fact, they were going to move him, switch. I didn't follow his career this year, but they were going to move him to wide receiver. But I do think that when you watch players who have transferred and you look at this year, look at the impact of transfers this year. I mean, Joe Burrow was a transfer. Justin Fields was a transfer. Jacob Eason up at Washington, he was a transfer. All of these guys got to make major impacts on their team in their conference, or in the case of Joe Burrow and Justin Fields, on the national level because of the transfer rules being relaxed a little bit. And I think they could be relaxed a little bit more. I know a lot of coaches don't agree with that, but I know a lot of other coaches, more big name coaches, are now coming out and saying, we don't really have a problem with it.
Yeah, it's just I've never understood them not giving that opportunity to college athletes. It's something where coaches are able to leave, right? At any moment, any time, a coach can accept another offer at another university and say, you know what, thank you, I appreciate my time here, but I'm leaving. Why aren't these athletes afforded that same opportunity to say, you know what, I loved it here, this just wasn't my spot or wasn't my time. Someone maybe got the best of me, but I have a chance to go show what I can do somewhere else.
Yeah, absolutely. And there are fans who will come out and say, well, you can't equate the player that wants to leave a program with a coach because one's a professional, one's making money, and it's a different set of circumstances. And I just think that's a bunch of nonsense. Coaches can come and go. Just to go back for a second, when Willie Taggart was at Oregon and they were getting ready for the bowl game, and suddenly he decided to go to Florida State and he wanted to go home, and he didn't coach them in the bowl game, but he had brought players in. He had recruited players that were going to sign with Oregon for the early signing period. Well, Mario Cristobal ends up coaching Oregon in the bowl game against Boise State, in which Boise State won. Willie Taggart goes on to Florida State. I think the players who got recruited and signed at Oregon should have been allowed to get out of their national letter of intent and go to wherever they wanted to go. That wasn't the case, and it's things like that where coaches suddenly leave after a signing period. In this case, he had left just before it, but the coaches will leave a week or 2 weeks after a signing period, and a player will say, wait a minute, you were in my living room talking to my grandparents, talking to my parents, I signed with you, and now a week later you've moved to this university, and the NCAA says to the student, well, that's too bad, and it shouldn't be too bad.
It shouldn't be. You do have these coaches, though, that do respect, right, that early signing period. Peterson, he decided to step down before all of this occurred, so kids can make the decision that was right for them. Jeff Tedford here at Fresno State, he decided to make the announcement before it so that he gave the guys he was recruiting that opportunity to say, either I do want to go to Fresno State or I don't want to go to Fresno State. But there is a circumstance that the guy just sees a new job and says, yeah, I'm going to take that. And you leave the student there or the athlete that's just like, well, I came here for you. Like I wanted to be coached by you. Now you're leaving. Now, like, why am I stuck here?
Yeah, exactly right. And I mean, I've got my own stories, my own about when I was recruited and what have you. And there was, I mean, on my recruiting trip to one SEC school for basketball, while I was en route, and it was four planes to get there. This was a long time ago. While I was en route, there was a coaching change. And so I went from being a guy that they were going to offer a scholarship to a guy, as I learned when I got there, they wanted the red shirt. And, I mean, this happened in a matter of hours en route to the school, and that changed my view completely. I crossed them off the list. I stayed there for the weekend, but I wanted nothing to do with it. But I was glad that I learned that ahead of time, because if that would have happened after I'd signed, it would be a whole different story. And, of course, back then, I make it sound like it's the 1800s, just about. But back then, the rules were even tighter.
Yeah.
So coming up, we're going to switch to boxing and a little dollop of MMA. Big man is here, Derek X. This is the CGP.
You're listening to the Christopher Gabriel Program on 940 ESPN and 940ESPNFresno.com.
You cannot quit me so quickly. There's no hope in you for me.
Christopher Gabriel returns.
No corner you could squeeze me. But I got all the time for you, love. The space between the tears we cry is the laughter keeps us coming back for more. The
space Retro Bumper Friday, Dave Matthews. You know, Derek made the point, we're going to get to Derek X in a moment. Derek made the point that because this is your first Super Bowl roundtable, I don't know if you knew this, but there is a tiny producer's table that you'll be sitting at. It's like the kids' table, you'll be at the tiny producer's table.
As long as my legs fit under it, that's okay.
They may not.
Oh.
I'll let you know that.
Well, I appreciate the warning.
All right, you mean you're a valid and important voice, but it's going to be a different table. All right, everybody's been through that.
Can I put at least a piece of paper on it or something?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, you can. Okay. We'll have a little name card for you.
Okay, yeah.
Be a tiny one, though.
Can it fit my whole Mexican name on there?
Oh, yeah, it'll fit that.
Okay.
And I'm not going to say the fact that you're a Braves fan has anything to do with this. It's just the way it goes.
Yeah, I'll take my time.
All right, you're adaptable. I've noticed that about you. We appreciate that. We kid because we care. Derek X is the elite boxing mind of this program, and I think the time is coming that we need to have him joining us more often than every other week. He is in studio right now. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing great. How about you, CG?
Very well. You sent me a note earlier in the week saying we're going to go Philly style, and I thought that meant that you were having Pat's steaks or Tony Luke's steaks brought in for the morning. That would have been a great buffet.
You know what, though? But with the loyalties on that, that would have been a bigger brawl than any fight we got coming
up. Boy, you got that right. People are serious about their cheesesteaks in Philly. Well, let's start. I'm going to let you run with this because you threw a couple of names my way, and you mentioned Boots Ennis. His name is it Jerron?
Jerron Boots Ennis. Yes,
yeah,
sir.
And he fought one of my favorite names I've ever heard, Bakhtiar Yubov. Boots was 24-0. He's 25-0.
Correct.
Now, and Bakhtiar going into the fight was 14-1-1 with 12 knockouts. They fought last week.
Right.
Tell me what we need to know and why we need to know about Boots Ennis.
Well, and I know we're kind of going backwards here a little bit. We usually kind of look at fights.
Well, that's me every day on this program.
But you still look like you're moving forward.
Thank you. See how he throws the love? You throw age jokes and he throws the love. We call that experience.
Well, I paid my dues at the kids' table, too.
Yeah, and I did, too. My first day as a host, I was at the kids' table with Andrew Zimmern. I was in the corner, a little tiny little table.
I'm looking forward to it.
All right. Very good.
Well, I want people to be more aware of Jerron Boots Ennis. And it is a great nickname, but I want to tell everybody that that was a mistake. A lot of people call him Boots. What happened was is when he was a kid, he's got a father and his two brothers. He's been in boxing his whole life. He's been in the gym since he was 9 months old. He was called Boops, B-O-O-P-S, which was short for a nickname his mother gave him of Boopsy. And in the gym, somebody mistakenly heard his father call him Boots. They thought it was Boots, and here we are today with Boots. And it's a great nickname.
Boots is a great nickname, yeah. I mean, I think as you look at the kind of fighter that he is, and Boots fits him more than Boops.
It absolutely does, because he has the boots with his skill and his footwork, how tactical he is, how precise he is, the strength that he has, the body build that he has. He has been touted probably. Now, they still keep calling him a prospect. I think he's more of the contender status. But the problem is, because of his records and the skills he brings to the table at the welterweight division, people in the top 10 are afraid to fight him. He has had fights where they were scheduled, and then all of a sudden fighters have pulled out. He's been ranked number 13, I believe, by the WBO as a contender. For him to get those title fights, he needs to move further up in the rankings. Well, what's happening is the other fighters that are in the top 10s don't really want to fight him. He has the skills. He has the abilities. This man is going to make a name for himself. He's been touted as the best prospect since 1984 gold medalist Meldrick Taylor. Now, Meldrick Taylor, if I'm right, was like 38-8. He was a two-division champ. This man brought notoriety back again to Philly at that time. This is what Boots Ennis is going to do. He's going to make a name.
Yeah, and I need to ask you about this, because you've brought this up with a couple of different fighters. We're talking with Derek X, and that is guys are afraid to fight him. Well, if you are a boxer, and this might sound like a real, real pedestrian question, D, but if you're in professional boxing and you're you know where I'm going with this, and your goal is to rise up the ladder, so you can't avoid these guys. Sooner or later, you got to fight the big guys.
You have to. The best is the best. I mean, look what Clemson did. They made their name after beating Alabama. And that's what's going to happen is Jerron is going to force the hands on this. He has a promoter, Cameron Duncan, who was a co-manager of Terrence Crawford. Okay? He says that Boots Ennis is by far the best talent he ever has signed. He says that if it comes to a Crawford-Ennis fight, which they're in the same weight division, will it happen? I don't know. But Crawford, he needs a fight like this, too, to get more notoriety for him so he can fight an Errol Spence or maybe a Manny Pacquiao. And some people would think, well, that's the man's promoter, you know, that's what he's going to say. Let me throw this out to you. This guy has signed Donaire, Mikey Garcia, Diego Corrales, Timothy Bradley. He's had 35 world champions as a promoter and a manager. And he says Jerron Ellis, Boots, is going to be the best of all of them. This kid has skills. He has the ability. He will hurt you with either hand. He can fight southpaw or orthodox to where such a style, he's like Roy Jones Jr. It has strength and power either way. And he's very methodical at what he does. He doesn't overextend himself. He doesn't get caught. When he was fighting Ubob, he destroyed him. Knocked him down twice in the first round. Given Ubob his credit and his dues, he kept coming. But he was getting pounded so much, the ref just had to stop the fight in the fourth round.
When I lived in Philly, you would go through North Philly, you'd go through West Philly, you'd go through South Philly, and you couldn't go very far without running by a boxing gym.
Yes.
Are boxing gyms, is Philadelphia the same level of boxing hub as it used to be 30, 40, 50 years ago?
It's coming back, yes, sir. You know, there are a lot of, because of the world that we live in, you know, and the quantified mathematics of the populations and the centers that we have, we're starting to see these individuals who don't want to do the other sports, and now they're starting to make a name for themselves fighting as an individual. And yes, so you're seeing California, Philly, New York, you're seeing a lot of these hubs where there's a lot of young talent coming out that's going to be scary in the next couple of years.
We're talking with Derek X, as we always do every couple of weeks. Sometimes we have emergency boxing segments when something's going on and we need to get the man in here ASAP. And then there's J-Rock Williams, Julian Williams. He's fighting tonight. Let's talk about him a little bit.
Actually, he's fighting on the 18th.
18th. Yes. Why do I say tonight?
That's
jeez.
Okay. And he's from Philly, too, and he is fighting in Philly.
Well, I'm off a day.
You know?
I'm off one day.
No, you're just ahead of the time.
Yes. And he's fighting, I think, on Temple's campus at the Leocura
yes,
Center.
He is. Yeah. You are absolutely right. And I did not know how to pronounce that center, so I was just going to say Temple.
Leocura, yeah.
He had a fight in which he beat Jared Hurd, and this was kind of a fight of the year candidate, and he became a unified champion at 154. He's got the WBA super welterweight, the IBF, and the IBO. Now, the IBO is the redheaded stepchild of all of them. You know, they're second tier as far as the belt. But either way, he has three belts. He's unified. A lot of individuals were hoping for a better matchup for his first title defense than Jenson Rosario. But Rosario's no cakewalk, okay? This is going to be quite a fight. And the mindset of Julian J-Rock Williams and his trainer, I think they call him Breadcrumbs or something like that.
Breadcrumbs.
The name is Breadman Edwards. He's got him focused at this point to where he even mentioned Andy Ruiz, because Andy Ruiz stepped in the ring, got three titles that a lot of people didn't think he was going to get, but then faltered. Because of that, there's been extra focus from Julian J-Rock Williams on this. He's going to continue to escalate up. What needs to happen for him now is after this fight, he needs to fight some of the other fighters at the WBO and the WBA, Jermell Charlo and Patrick Teixeira, to get, he has the ability to become unified. This man is talented, he is strong, and he's going to put on a show in Philadelphia. A lot of his fights have been in Philadelphia, but the man has performed. This is going to be, I think, in the first couple of rounds, more of a match than people thought it was going to be, but it's going to be a great fight.
Is there when you look at? I'm interested in the fact that we're talking about a couple of guys from Philly. Is there a style that goes hand in hand with boxers who have come out of Philly? You know, you might look at guys who are coming out of gyms in the Central Valley, or guys that are coming out of gyms from South Side of Chicago, or the North Side of Chicago. Is there a style for fighters that come out of Philly?
I think the styles are more related to the trainers,
okay,
and the physical abilities of the fighters themselves. Now, mental toughness and physical toughness, those play a factor, as opposed to some of these, you know, Southern Cali guys who think they're tough, but then when you get to the aspect of what it actually takes as far as a mental mindset, you know, because there are some players, going back to Boots Ennis, one of his last fights, he was taught a lesson in the ring. And the words that he used is, I'm fighting for a man who does this to feed his family. And he got elbows, he got headbutts, he got thrown to the ground. He learned that there are different aspects of boxing depending upon the mindset of your opponent. Julian J-Rock Williams, I believe, in this fight is going to make a statement and put the rest of the division on notice that I've got two of the belts, I'm coming for two more.
We're talking with Derek X. He is our elite boxing mind. Is there anything, since the last time we talked, and you and I didn't talk about this week, but is there anything new that we need to know about our guy, Jose Ramirez?
He's making some media tours right now.
I saw him, a picture of him on SportsCenter down in Los Angeles.
Yes, and he had, I think, four other subdivisions of ESPN than which he was doing interviews on, like ESPN Deportes and a couple others. He is putting in some very intense training, getting ready to head to Haiku. Right now, it's just getting prepped for the fight. And
okay.
Jose, I didn't think that he could actually do this, but it seems like his mental focus now is even at another level. His goal now is, yes, to win this fight, but it's going to be to try and unify. That's becoming his future goal now. And the mindset to try and get that done is intense. And it may happen, because if you look, Josh Taylor just signed with Top Rank 2. Okay. I believe that there was, I was telling people, I believe that there'll be a tune-up for each. Not necessarily a tune-up, because they're both going to have to defend belts. That's what the Victor Postol fight is for, Jose. Josh Taylor, it looks like, yes, the IBF, who always wants, they want to make a name for themselves, but they're always the first one to say, here's my mandatory, here's our mandatory.
Right.
Well, that's what's happened with Josh. He's already been given his mandatory. His mandatory, if it happens, will probably happen, you know, May, June, and that may work out to where in the fall, early winter, maybe we can see a unification fight at that time. But we've got to look at a guy, a fighter named Catterall. He is a fighter that is a contender, and he's been put on the back burner. He's been a mandatory for the WBO for a while. He got bought out on the Maurice Hooker. He was supposed to fight Maurice Hooker. He got bought out and told to sit on the sidelines. Well, what happens? Hooker loses to Jose. Jose has the belts now. Catterall is looking for that quality fight now. Sooner or later, Catterall is going to have to get into the mix. So between the WBO and the IBF, that may be some problems as to unifying all four belts. But I look, because they're on the same platform, they want to get visually Josh Taylor out there for at least one fight. I look for, in the latter half of next year, for those two fighters to fight.
That's great. That's great stuff right there. Coming up with Derek, we're gonna transfer to the Octagon, and we're gonna talk about Conor McGregor and Cowboy. Is it Cerrone?
Cerrone.
Cowboy,
yes,
Cerrone. Just he's got a big old hat.
Yes, he does.
McGregor's gonna make a nice piece of change on this fight. I guess they both are, but McGregor will make a lot more.
Probably 10 times.
That's
more.
Ridiculous. My yes. goodness. More with Derek X coming up. This is the CGP.
You're listening to the Christopher Gabriel Program on 940 ESPN. More of the Christopher Gabriel Program right now on 940 ESPN.
Charlottesville, Virginia, Dave Matthews, Dave Matthews Band, Retro Bumper Friday. This is one of the greatest songs ever recorded, Ants Marching. They have such complex music and complex charts. As a drummer, I listen to his drummer, and I'm just amazed at how good he is. Oh, you know, we talk about people like Neil Peart, who we lost in the last week, who was, as far I think, the best there ever was, maybe next to guys like Buddy Rich and Gene Krupa. But you had him, you had John Bonham, who just, they did things that you just, you couldn't replicate. That's why Led Zeppelin never went back out on tour. John Bonham, you couldn't replicate what he did. He didn't write anything down, just this is what he did. And that's the kind of drum charts that you have with Dave Matthews' drummer, and they're just, their arrangements are so good. So I hope you're enjoying it as well. We are enjoying the company of Derek X. We don't get to talk about MMA too much, but Conor McGregor and Cowboy Cerrone are going to get things going, and there's a lot of money here. And McGregor hasn't done a whole lot, and yet he's going to make a whole lot.
And you're exactly right on that, CG. He really hasn't, but he is. That's why I asked if we could talk about this. No, you know, the Octagon as opposed to the squared circle is not really in my wheelhouse, but this is such a high-profile fight, and a lot of people are so excited, but it's not for a belt. It's not for a title. It is just a fight.
And we had Brian Ortega in this studio once.
There
yeah.
you go.
Yeah.
Yes.
He glared at me a lot. I thought he was going to go over the table just for no reason. Yeah.
Well, you got enough distance.
Yeah,
there,
a little bit. Yeah.
This is going to be a platform-setting fight for McGregor to try and get at least two more fights in the next year. If you look at what Conor has put together to still be at the forefront. You were talking about who's going to make what. Now, Cowboy Cerrone is no joke. This is his 50th MMA fight. He has made a lot of statements in the ring, but he's never won a title. Okay? McGregor, his last win, now let's think about this, was in 2016.
That's crazy.
He became the first two-division champ in the UFC, but he hasn't won anything since then.
And we've known him better. in the last couple of years for the things he's done that are headline worthy for the wrong reasons.
And they absolutely were for the wrong reasons. And there's a reason behind it. This man, though, kind of came clean in the last couple of weeks. Some of what you're talking about happened and circled around the Khabib fight.
Yes.
You know, throwing the railing through the bus.
Yeah.
That caused fights to be postponed and canceled. Not just his, others. He was sued. This man, he's kind of been coddled. But it's come out to the fact that before the Khabib fight, this man was drinking every day. He had individuals who fought the same style and had the same mindset as Khabib in his hotel room. They'd go down and fight. You know, he'd knock these guys out, and then he'd disappear for 3 or 4 or 5 days drinking. He was drinking before the fights. And that was always a big knock on him, was his conditioning. His mindset wasn't there. Now, this is what makes it scary. It is there for this fight. This fight has a lot of odds that have, or factors that have changed, that it's going to make it a great fight. Normally, both these fighters will fight at 145. They're coming in at 170 on this. So the extra weight may play a factor that's better for Cerrone, because Cerrone has the great ground game. If he gets McGregor to the ground, it's going to be tough for McGregor to win. And if you look at McGregor's losses, 4 of them are by submission on the ground. McGregor's better on his feet. He is very tactical. He is very straightforward. His step back left has knocked a bunch of people out. He has that ability and an IQ in the ring that is unmatched. It's whether that focus can be there. I do believe the focus will be there. When the odds first came out on this fight, it was pretty much a pick'em. McGregor at minus 185, Cerrone at a plus 125. It's spread out a little bit to where McGregor's around a minus 300 favorite, but it's going to be something that whose style is going to be dominant in the ring. I think McGregor comes back. He needs to make a statement, because we're talking about money on this. McGregor holds no titles. He hasn't won since 2016. He's going to make between 60 to 80 million on this fight. He is the face of the MMA. He needs this win to keep moving forward. Cerrone gets him on the ground, it's game over. Cerrone, though, has the ability to lose focus at times and kind of shy away when the bright lights happen. And he has lost 2 out of his last 3 fights.
So quickly, because Dana White probably wants him to win too, who wins?
I believe that McGregor ends it by about the 3rd round. I'm going to go with the TKO instead of a submission.
All right, Derek X, always a pleasure, my man.
Thank you, sir.
All right, coming up next, Friday Picks, Tony Landry. This is the CGP.
The Los Angeles Lakers, 940 ESPN, the Valley's local sports leader, KFIG Fresno. Live from the studios of 940 ESPN in Fresno, California, this is the Christopher Gabriel Program.
Hour number 2 Friday morning begins right now. It's not hour number 2 of Friday morning. We're actually in the ninth hour, even though it's 8:04. But it's hour number 2 of the program. That does begin right now, 4 minutes, 32 seconds past the aforementioned 8 a.m. here on the Pacific Coast, which puts it a few minutes after 11 out in beautiful Washington, D.C. And that is where I believe, you never know, because the man travels more than travel writers for magazines. That is where I believe we will find Mr. Tony Landry, the producer of Big Ten This Morning on SiriusXM. Mr. Landry, good morning to you.
I'm still trying to figure out the math on what time and what hour we are in. But I've
confused myself here. Yeah, is it?
I'm taking a shoe off to do some math now.
Yeah, it because what happens is a lot of times it's – I've never understood how if it's 8:05 here, you'll say, well, no, it's 10:40 here in D.C., and that completely confuses me.
You know, I'll honestly admit this. Every once in a while I'll be sitting in my apartment doing some work for the show, and it'll be, you know, say like 3:30, and I'm like, it's really only lunchtime for Christopher. really weird.
It is very weird.
The three different time zones really throws me off. But it is funny you mentioned that I travel quite a bit. I've been meaning to tell you that next Friday I'm going to be on a cruise, so I'm not going to make the Christopher Gabriel program.
You know what? All right. So a couple of things about that. Number one, Lady Catherine, she's behind this, isn't it? She got you on a cruise.
Oh, it's her whole family and her. Yes,
of course it is.
Yeah. They're cruise people. Apparently, I've found out, and well, I have never been on one. So
I never have either. I've been on a dinghy. I've done that. I've been in a canoe. This is a true story. I was in a canoe on a lake in the Finger Lakes region of New York, up near Ithaca, New York, where Cornell is at. And I lost the paddle. It fell out of the boat. And I didn't know how to get back. And it was just, the whole thing was a mess. And I had to have a boat with a couple of gals who were up there with us on the trip come by and, like, basically save me in the middle of the lake. I mean, I could have swam back to shore. But then I'm thinking, because I'm a city guy, idiot here, I'm thinking to myself, well, what if there's, like, you know, like some sort of electric eel or something in the lake?
There's a kraken in the lake up near the Finger Lakes.
Yeah, exactly. And then, you know, people back at the area where we were all staying saying, yeah, CG, there's no electric eels here. It's a lake.
It may have been like a perch. If you're interested in a book involving the word canoe, ironically, Nick Offerman's biography, Paddle Your Own Canoe, is worth the read. I took it in the summer. And Nick Offerman, of course, of Parks and Rec fame, and from Minooka, Illinois. I'm sure you've probably traveled through Minooka once or twice.
Spent a weekend at the Hyatt there. Yeah, the Minooka Hyatt. It's very nice.
I hear nothing but good things about the Continental Breakfast. But
it's outstanding.
Big Chicago guy.
Yeah. They actually use three different types of meat in their sausage at the Continental Breakfast, and it's outstanding. I would also say, you know, there's also canoe cologne. You remember the old ad campaign before your time was do you canoe? Canoe.
I mean,
I'm just saying.
You have taken this to a place even for you and I where I'm actually kind of impressed.
Well, you know what? It's
been a weird Friday morning, to say the least.
Well, it has. And I can tell you that the reason I went there with you on the cologne is because on the canoe boxes, they had a series of flags that you would see on a boat. So I'm trying to, you see what I'm doing here? I'm trying to bring it back all to the fact that I'm a little bitter that you're going to be on the cruise with the gal and the family. Now, big points are going to be scored because she just hung out with your family and you had the picture of you guys under the Fargo Theater marquee, and that was nice. And I always feel like those are little shots at me because you know that I missed the Midwest just to come back and see it. But now you're going to do the family thing with them. I think we can say this is getting serious.
Oh, certain. I mean, if you're going to spend 5 days on a boat trying. So it's funny, when you tell people you're going on a cruise, you get a wide variety of responses. Some people are excited. Some people kind of turn their nose up at boat travel. And a lot of people, like, their first question is, do you think you're going to get sick?
Yeah.
Not a lot of activities in life involving a vacation where people look at you and go, I think you're going to need some Dramamine? It's a weird thing to have to respond to people.
Yeah, you're right about that. And I've never been on a cruise because a friend of mine was on a cruise, and it was one of those cruises where the whole boat there was...
Andrea Dory?
It wasn't that one. That's going back a little bit. But it wasn't the Titanic, which was that was ill-fated, you may remember. But he was on a cruise, him and his wife, and the boat got basically broke down. How does a cruise line break down? And then there was an illness.
It was supposed to be a three-hour tour.
Yes, exactly. You know, that could give us a cue to play some Gilligan's Island music, you know, if we need to. I mean, it's always there at the ready. That may find its way onto the program in the next couple of minutes. But
next year's pick segment is going to be the Gilligan's Island theme music.
Absolutely. By the way, might as well go ahead and ask you, Ginger or Marianne?
Probably Ginger.
No, it's got to be Marianne.
No?
It's got to be Marianne.
I mean, the show ended before I was alive, so.
Bob Crane? I was hoping that we'd get to Gilligan's Island there for a second, but that's all right. We had the pirate music, which would go as well. You know, the whole program's just falling apart at this point.
It is unraveling faster than Major League Baseball right now.
It is, but I will tell you that my fear of going on a cruise is probably one that I shouldn't have, but it's falling off the boat. Can fall off the boat, can't you?
if there is a way to do that, I'm sure I will find it. I've been told there are. So my perceived notions of these cruises are what you see on TV. There's giant slides, there's wave pools, there's all of these, you know, fancy nightlife and stuff like that. I'm really looking to do, like, I'm going to download a book to listen to. I'm going to probably try to find a shuffleboard game that I can get in the mix with some, you know, some retirees. There's a bingo hall. There's a casino. I'm essentially looking to live my best retired, you know, West Palm Beach life that I could live.
I think
I've been told that Catherine's father has picked out a Tommy Bahama shirt for me.
Oh, you're gonna have the Tommy Bahama shirt, and you'll have. Yeah, here we go.
There we go.
This is it.
Files under things I didn't think I'd hear this morning.
Yeah, so, well, you know, we're full service on this program. I was always
I
a Marianne
more than
guy.
Anyone.
So you're gonna have the Tommy Bahama shirt. And you're going to have the cargo shorts, the Birkenstocks, and the socks as you're playing bocce ball or shuffleboard. That is just a – with the beard, and you're going to have the Tiger Woods golf cap.
And Saul from Brooklyn just having the time of our lives.
I'm telling you.
Hanging out on a boat.
Yeah, another order of pierogies, please. That's, you know.
Trying to catch the early bird at 4:30.
Yeah, and then some of the family members are going to be like, I don't know about him. I just don't know.
I do declare.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess it is about that. I guess it is about that time for the pirate music. Yeah. Last week.
The other boat movies I could reference.
You know, you could dress as a pirate and go out. You know, the night that you have dinner at the captain's table, where everybody's wearing the suits and ties with the tuxedos, and you show up looking like Johnny Depp in Pirates of the Caribbean. I want to see pictures of that.
It would be Tuesday, wouldn't it? That is my normal attire.
It is, exactly. I've heard from my insiders at Sirius XM that you do bring that sort of element. You used to do that in mornings.
I told that in confidence to John Jansen.
Yeah. Well, you know, he told me that back in August that you did that, and I, who knew? But again, I'm looking for the picture on Twitter.
Yeah, give it time. I mean, you really just, you know, when you're dressing as a pirate on a boat, you have to make sure that, you know, everything goes accordingly, because I feel like that could go bad in a hurry.
Does Lady Catherine wear the pirate's gal wear, or does she go full pirate as well?
Oh, no, full pirate. If we're going to do this, we're going to go all the way.
I can see that. Well, you know what? We are almost to the end of Friday Picks, unless we go into basketball season a little bit. Last week, we both went 5-1. We both lost, foolishly thinking that Lamar Jackson and the Baltimore Ravens would beat the Titans, and apparently both of us have underrated the Titans too many times. 5-1 each, and that puts you at a very impressive 110-58. I am 102-66. Really no chance of catching up here, so I've worked through my bitterness over the last couple of weeks and found my way to come into grips with it. And then we have two games left: Kansas City, Tennessee, San Francisco, Green Bay, and somewhere in the mix there's going to be another burrito involved, breakfast burrito involved. Derek is hanging out with us, and he said that he feels another controversy is on the horizon.
You know, it's the thing about Friday Picks that I think a lot of people forget is we do this from like August, correct?
Yeah.
Is
yes.
usually when we start.
That's
this?
When we start. Yep.
I'll be honest, the burrito gate in D.C. seems like years ago at this point.
And
for you, it seems like about an 8-pick lead ago.
Yeah, you didn't need to say that, but it does. And, you know, you've now sort of rekindled the bitterness in me. So I set up the whole burrito gate conclusion with the lovely Lady Catherine, and all I asked was one thing. I asked for one thing. I asked for a picture, and I didn't get that.
You did provide me quite a meal at District Taco.
Yes.
And actually, you know, ironically, I ate it in Arlington, Virginia, not in D.C., but so,
wait,
you know, all the same.
You got it to go?
Well, no, we ate there.
Oh, you ate there. Oh, you went to
there's
that?
One
I
down
see.
The,
I got it.
Yeah.
All right.
There's one down the street.
All right.
It seemed foolish to cross the Potomac to go get tacos when we had tacos right down the street.
Nobody crosses the Potomac to get a taco when you have one down the street. That's ridiculous.
That's you know, just drive to Georgetown. I'm not asking for a lot here. Go see Patrick Ewing.
That's exactly right. Patrick Ewing, by the way, is he as popular as a coach there now as he was as a player?
You know, it's really kind of weird. I really thought when I moved out here, Georgetown was going to be a bigger part of my District of Columbia experience. They're almost kind of a forgotten thing here in the city. Not a lot of people talk about them.
You don't see, well, yeah, and Georgetown itself, the actual city of Georgetown, when I think of you and nightlife, I don't think of you as being a Georgetown guy because that is a very button-down, forget about the congressional part of it, you know, but that is a very different crowd than the Tony Landry from Grand Forks, North Dakota that I know.
Yeah, that area, well, lovely. It's more of a go have dinner and leave, only just because it's the affluent part of Washington, D.C. It is where the Obamas have a condo. I know there's always the running joke in town here because there's been a brownstone for sale there forever that's cost $30 million. Morning radio producers and $30 million condos don't really go hand in hand all that well.
No, neither do afternoon drive hosts. It doesn't work out that way. Well, we do have two games to look at. Let's start with Kansas City hosting the Tennessee Titans at Arrowhead. Tony, this should be a great game. And if you would have said to me 4 or 5 weeks ago the AFC Championship is going to be the Chiefs and the Titans, I would have thought, okay, number one, how did the Titans get in there? Number two, how many touchdowns are the Chiefs going to beat them by? But I don't think that's the way this game shapes up.
You know, it's really weird. And we kind of referenced it last week when we talked about this, where it's kind of hard for a team to get hot like they do in the Stanley Cup playoffs and kind of barnstorm their way through the playoffs. Well, turns out Derrick Henry can do that. The most alarming thing I think I've seen statistically this year in NFL football is Ryan Tannehill is 2-0 in the playoffs for throwing for 160 total yards.
Incredible.
It's no touchdowns, 160 total yards. That won that man two playoff games. And again, you look at it from it's almost people are finding this weird nostalgia in the Tennessee Titans right now because they play good defense and they're just trucking people with their, you know, Mack truck of a running back.
Right.
And, you know, just kind of this Trent Dilfer-esque quarterback going out and winning games when he doesn't have to do a whole lot. It's just kind of, you know, 70s and 80s football. And then you had whatever the world the Kansas City Chiefs and the Houston Texans played in. I was golfing during the beginning of that game and we were sitting there and it was 24-0 going, wow, really going to have to sit through a Texans-Titans AFC South playoff or AFC Championship playoff game. And then Patrick Mahomes remembered who he was and they rattled off 31 unanswered and played that kind of football that only the Chiefs really have the ability to turn on the dime. Maybe sans the Baltimore Ravens, and, well, how did that work out for them?
Right.
So the AFC divisional weekend was really just, you know, it was very drunk and very weird in the fact that everything you thought was going to happen didn't happen. I don't really know. I know Kansas City is currently, the airport is closed because of an ice storm that's going through the area. This is one of those things, again, where Kansas City doesn't really deal with ice very well. The whole city is going to be kind of upside down and backwards. I don't know if this is going to help or hurt the Chiefs. I don't think the Titans are going to want to go from Nashville to Kansas City and play in a cold weather game. But again, if you got to play in cold weather or the elements, you need a running game. And they have a running game. This is one of those situations where the at-home advantage that the Chiefs are going to get with their electric playmaking quarterback really kind of comes down to, if you score quickly, are you going to be able to keep them out of the end zone? And I honestly don't think the Chiefs have the ability to play a lot of defense, but they can play a whole lot of offense. So my gut tells me the Chiefs, you know, have to win because the Cinderella story and the other shoe is going to drop on Tennessee at some point. So I'll take the safe bet and go with Kansas City.
I'm going with the not-so-safe bet, and I'm going to say that weather may play a factor, and I do believe that Tennessee's run is not just a Cinderella run. I think it's a team that has found themselves, and they have found the magic formula of Derrick Henry. He's I mean, it's not like they just discovered that he could run the football, but and your comparison of Tannehill to Dilfer is spot on. I just think that they reminded me. I went on one of our music stations this morning, and I said, this run of Tennessee reminds me of a number of years ago when the Oakland Raiders were a wild card, and they found their way all the way to the Super Bowl to play the Ron Jaworski, Bill Berge, Harold Carmichael, Wilbert Montgomery Eagles, and most people thought that the Raiders' magic was going to run out when they got to the Super Bowl, and in fact, they beat the Eagles 27-10. I'm not saying that I think the Titans are going to win the Super Bowl, but I do think that Derrick Henry is going. I think they're going to have a lot of ball control. They're going to the game plan is going to be to keep Patrick Mahomes off the field, and they've got the guy to do it. I'm going to go with Tennessee in this game.
Yeah.
Yep.
No good.
No. Go ahead.
I was going to say it really. I just hope for a good football game.
Yeah.
It just seems like if for some reason the magic does wear out, you don't really want to see an AFC championship game where one team scores 60 and the other one scores 3.
Yeah, no, I'm with you there for sure. The other game is just up the road from here at beautiful Levi's Stadium. I had the president of the 49ers on the program yesterday, Al Guido. Fascinating conversation. That, by the way, for listeners who missed it, that's going to be up on SoundCloud.com/CG program in a couple of minutes, or actually more like about 30 minutes. But 49ers hosting the Green Bay Packers. And the last time these teams played was week 12, 37-8 was the final. Aaron Rodgers, 20 for 33, 104 yards and one TD. Perhaps the worst loss of his career. Maybe it was. Devontae Adams, I feel like he was a little banged up in that game.
I don't think he played, actually.
No, he did. He had 7 receptions for 43 yards, yeah. But I think it was limited. In that game, Tony.
Recovering from his turf toe, maybe? Or maybe right before his turf toe?
Yeah, something like that. And I'll just say this. Aaron Rodgers is going to be the best player on this field. No two ways about that. But I don't know what the Packers, and I've said this a couple of times this week, and I sound like a broken record. I'm sorry, but I don't know what the Packers can do appreciably different. Same personnel on both sides of the ball. I don't know what they can do differently that's going to close the gap between these two teams. It's not a big gap between the teams. These are both very good football teams. But I'm going to go ahead and pick first on this. I'm going to go with the 49ers. I think the 49ers find their way back to the Super Bowl. I think this will be a great game. It's not going to be 37-8. It's going to be something very much closer, I believe.
Yeah, this one's, the Packer fan in me wants to say Green Bay has a chance to win because, you know, Aaron Rodgers is going to keep teams in football games. He's done that in the past, and he's elevated his play in the playoffs. I think the biggest thing that is going to be kind of the key if the Packers decide they're going to try to neutralize the pass rush of the 49ers, you're going to see a lot of screens, you're going to see a lot of quick slants. Just try to pick up 5 or 6 yards at a time, because when you have 4 guys picked in the first round that are in your pass rush, you're going to get to the quarterback, and Aaron Rodgers doesn't quite have the mobility of Aaron Rodgers of 3 or 4 years ago, and he could kind of slip underneath and go pick up a first down with his legs. I think the skill position players obviously are in favor of the San Francisco 49ers on offense. But the biggest key is, Jimmy Garoppolo is still doing all of this for the first time, and he has this weird ability to win football games with kind of gross numbers. Like, he can throw for 210 yards and 2 touchdowns and an interception and a fumble or something like that, but he just finds a way to get the job done. I think it'll come down to if they can find a way to stop George Kittle. It really kind of comes down to that for me, because you can double people over the top on Sanders. You can move people around. They're going to pick up yards on the ground because that's what teams do against Green Bay, but George Kittle, once again, to me, seems like the X factor. If one of the Smith family members decides that they're just going to not let him beat them, I think Green Bay has a chance. I don't think they win, only just because it just seems to me that the defense for San Francisco is just going to be too much for an Aaron Rodgers with, Jake Kumerow being your third option on offense. It's almost too bad for Packer fans out there, because you're seeing them get to another NFC Championship game with a rookie head coach, and you think, okay, this is going forward, but, it kind of goes back to the last 3 or 4 years of Mike McCarthy, when they made no free agent signings. They didn't really do anything until last year, and you can still get to an NFC Championship game with 13 regular season wins with one legitimate offensive weapon. So I'm hoping for like a 35-31, you know, something where at least you're going to get to see some big plays. You know, you're going to be able to see some defense, maybe pick off a ball or two. But you're right. I mean, this just kind of seems like a year San Francisco has been having. They get a home game. And I would be very happy if I go 2-1 or 1-1 this week, but I still think San Francisco wins.
Good stuff all the way around, as always, from the man getting ready to go on a cruise, Tony Landry, producer of Big Ten this morning on Sirius XM. Mr. Landry, have a blast on that cruise, and then we will reconnect in a couple of weeks for Friday picks for the Super Bowl and maybe a couple of other games on that weekend.
We'll pick the Pro Bowl?
Oh, my gosh. That's... you know what? I'll call you on the boat, and we'll talk for 30 seconds about our interest in the Pro Bowl.
I look forward to it already.
Thank you, sir. Have a great time on your cruise. Always a pleasure to talk with you.
Always a pleasure being on the CGP.
All right, there you go. Mr. Tony Landry, nobody better on Friday Picks. Coming up, Nick Shager and the Weekend Look at Movies and a couple of cool series on Netflix. This is the CGP.
You're listening to the Christopher Gabriel Program on 940 ESPN. There may be no busier film critic, no greater elite movie mind than Nick Shager. He can talk Hollywood, Cannes, Sundance, Fargo, Budapest, Kathmandu. If there's a film to be seen or a film festival to attend, he is on it. Here's Nick Shager.
He is here once again, the official film critic for the CGP from Variety, Daily Beast, Yahoo Movies, and Esquire, Mr. Nick Shager. Nick, how are you today?
I am well. How are you, Christopher?
Doing very well. I'm excited for different reasons for the pieces that we're going to be covering this week. Let's start with Bad Boys for Life. I guess I like Will Smith. I've always missed the bus that is labeled Martin Lawrence. I don't know why. It just he never did it for me. But this is, did we need this this version, this third version?
Well, we're certainly getting this version quite a bit ways after the last version. You know, Bad Boys was a huge hit back in the mid-90s. It was the first film directed by Michael Bay, who has gone on to tremendous things. And it was such a well-received film, the original, that they got back together for a much bigger sequel in 2003, Bad Boys 2. And that movie is almost the pinnacle of what you might consider Michael Bay's cinema, which is just super over the top, really glossy, lots of sex and violence and profane banter. And it sort of solidified, you know, a certain type of 90s/2000 action film. But after that, we haven't had anything from either Will Smith or Martin Lawrence, you know, together. And now here we're 17 years later, and you do have to wonder, why do we have Bad Boys for Life? At this point, I think the ship has somewhat sailed on mass interest for the franchise. And to top that off even further, Michael Bay, the director, is not the director of this film. They have gotten a Belgian directing duo to take the helm. Yet, I have to admit, Bad Boys for Life turns out to be not as bad as one might have expected. You know, there's something to be said for the idea that, you know, I think Will Smith in particular knows that his sort of, you know, marquee action heyday is, if it's not passing him by, it has already passed him by a little bit. We saw that in last year's Gemini Man, where he plays a retired government operative who winds up having to fight his younger self or a younger clone of himself. We even saw it a little bit in the animated film Spies in Disguise, where he also plays a super suave spy who sort of is a little long in the tooth for modernity. And here, Bad Boys for Life plays into that. it definitely plays into the idea that Will Smith and Martin Lawrence are sort of too old for this stuff and are dragged in for one last go-round to fight more, you know, mob drug bosses. I think the film is best because it understands that it is sort of doing a throwback and that this probably is the last time around because this is a little stale at this point. But, you know, that sort of self-awareness gives it a little bit of levity, and the action scenes aren't as big as they were before. I think Michael Bay is a little missed here. But Smith and Lawrence, as the film goes on, get funnier. And that, coupled with the fact that the movie does know how to hit its beats, it's not great, but it's far, far from a disaster. And I think in the long run, it's a little bit more, it's restraint relative to its predecessors sort of gives it a little bit of an advantage. So if you like those movies, if you like these stars, I mean, this is actually going to sort of fit the bill.
And I shouldn't cast aspersions on the original, because the original was written by my college buddy, Doug Richardson. So, you know, but that was kind of my point. I'm surprised, I guess. Sometimes when you get into, my goodness, you and I have talked about this so many times, when you start getting into multiple, I'll call them episodes of a franchise, the quality goes down, and because all you could see the filmmakers or the studio really being interested in is the merchandise they're selling and, you know, the DVD sales or Blu-ray or whatever they are. But the fact that this passed the muster a little bit, I guess I'm a little surprised.
Yeah, I have to admit, I was totally surprised. It's a January release of what would have of a sequel to a franchise that was at one point an enormous blockbuster franchise. So you think here they are dumping it in the, you know, sort of a dead zone of January, and that's because they have no faith in it. But as I said, it turns out to be a somewhat efficient machine. I mean, look, it doesn't reinvent the wheel. It really leans heavily into its 90s action cliches. You've definitely seen this before, but the movie sort of knows that and treats this as, yeah, okay, we're going to give it to you one last time with these guys because you like them. And, you know, on those limited terms, it works.
We are talking with our good friend Nick Shager from Variety, Daily Beast, Yahoo Movies, and Esquire. All right, so we have a franchisee in Bad Boys for Life, and we have something of the same here with Doolittle, with Robert Downey Jr. When I think of Doolittle, as in Dr. Doolittle, I always go back to, I think it was the original with Rex Harrison, and it wasn't the greatest movie ever, but it was just out there enough that I always loved it. And if there's one issue that I have with Robert Downey, who I think is a very good actor, sometimes for me, and I don't know what happens here, I can't wait for you to tell us, he gets into Nicolas Cage stuff where he instead of doing one thing, he goes to this huge affectation, and it's like, what are you doing? So that's the part of Robert Downey Jr.'s work that gets me nuts.
Well, unfortunately, you're going to be disappointed then by this Robert Downey Jr. performance because, as you said, Doolittle stars Downey Jr. It's his first big movie since leaving Marvel, quote unquote. We'll see if he stays away for good. And he's trying to initiate another franchise here by sort of rebooting Dr. Doolittle, which, as you said, was made into a film in 1967 with Rex Harrison. That was a big musical. And then was actually remade in 1998 with Eddie Murphy. So here we get a big, lavish special effects extravaganza where Downey Jr.'s Dr. Doolittle has to go on some crazy quest to find a magic cure to save the queen. And he takes all his animal buddies along. And the movie is totally over the top in a horrible way. And I hate to use such strong language, but the movie is really a mess. It looks bad. It doesn't have any continuity or cohesiveness. The effects are awkward. The voices, there's an all-star cast voicing all the animals, but none of them are funny, and worse, they don't even match. The film is set in Victorian London, and yet you have John Cena talking like he's the guy, you know, the meathead down at the gym that you might see, you know, today. None of it makes any sense. And then at the epicenter of this just sort of whirling dervish of a film, you have Downey Jr. And Downey Jr. is doing less Nicolas Cage here than he is doing Johnny Depp in Pirates of the Caribbean. He affects this crazy Welsh accent that just doesn't seem to fit, and you can't even exactly place. You don't know what he's doing with it. He wears sort of, you know, elaborate, you know, sort of tattered, you know, motley clothes, and he sort of acts like a crazed swashbuckler, and the performance is all over the place. It's tonally off. I didn't have high hopes for Doolittle because there's been a lot of advance word from the production side that the movie was troubled, that they had had a lot of problems. The director didn't exactly have a firm grasp on all the effects work and all of that stuff. But even with the sort of low expectations I went into it with, it turned out to be worse than expected because it's really a mess. And I think the fact that this big film with Downey Jr. is coming out now is somewhat of an indictment of the film and proof that the studio sort of knows that it didn't work and better to just sort of cut our losses here in January. So unless you have kids and you're really desperate for something this weekend, I mean, I would avoid it because as an adult, I'm not sure how you're going to, you know, sit through it and tolerate it.
Nick, there's so much we could unpack there that was delicious. I'm going to use that word. But there's one thing that jumps out at me, and it is sort of tied into where I started talking about Robert Downey Jr. There's an old phrase in theater rehearsal halls, and it's tried and true, and it goes back several hundred years, and that is, let the script play you, don't play the script. In other words, you know, get in the canoe and go where the current takes you, and then layer things on within the current. And that really, what you said, is really what gets me crazy when I see Robert Downey Jr. or Nicolas Cage do something like that, because yeah, the is it a Welsh accent? Is it Liverpool? Is it Northern England? And it's almost as if, from what you're saying, he decided on the performance and character that he wanted to give, and then let's just let the rest of the film fit around me.
Yeah, I think, you know, I wonder if, I agree completely, and I wonder if there was also a sense on his part that the movie itself and that the script was something of a mess and needed, you know, whatever embellishment he could give it. Or, you know, there's also the sense, I think, sometimes of trying to live up to the effects.
Yeah.
He knows he's going to be surrounded by a million, you know, sort of crazy animals. There's a gorilla and ducks and squirrels and whatnot. And so that he has to be almost as big and cartoonish as those characters, which, of course, he can't necessarily see all the time when he's filming because some of them are computer-generated. The whole thing winds up being really something of a mess. And I think it needed a much stronger directorial hand, although the truth is, I'm also not sure if there's, on top of all of these problems, just a sense from a lot of people that we didn't need another Dr. Doolittle, and that Dr. Doolittle himself isn't necessarily so exciting that he could, on his own, sort of spearhead a really gigantic effects-heavy franchise. Even the remake with Eddie Murphy was a reasonably small-scaled affair that was obviously directed at kids. This wants to be bigger than that. It wants to be a blockbuster, and I'm not exactly sure there's an audience for that.
You know, at any point during your disseminating the information on Doolittle, somebody just jumping in hearing this might have thought you were talking about Major League Baseball.
Well, that's a bit of a mess, too, these days, as everybody knows. And, there are a lot of people sinking in the middle of that as well. So, you know, yeah, everywhere you look.
Well, you know, I'm sure that Carlos Beltran and A.J. Hinch will be joining each other's company and watching Doolittle together at this point. We're talking with elite film critic Nick Shager, exclusive to this program, and we're happy about that. Variety, Daily Beast, Yahoo Movies, and Esquire. All right, so Killer Inside, the mind of Aaron Hernandez, this is a three-part Netflix series, and I've already heard from people saying things like, all right, I watched the first one, and I have questions. I watched the first one, and I had no idea of this, this, and this. It sounds from people that I've spoken to that this gives you some stuff that maybe you weren't or we weren't aware of.
It does. You know, the director of this new series, Killer Inside, which is on Netflix now, actually directed a documentary about Aaron Hernandez in late 2018. And actually, it played a few festivals, and I wound up reviewing it. So this three-part series, when I was watching it, I thought initially that it was just going to be sort of a protracted version of that film. And to some extent, it is. But there's a lot of stuff here that wasn't in that original film and that I, and I think a lot of other people, were unaware of. Certainly, it covers the bases. It covers the 2015 murder that he was of Odin Lloyd, that Aaron Hernandez was originally tried and convicted for. It then also covers the 2012 double homicide that he was tried for and was not convicted for. It covers the shooting of one of his associates as well. It goes into his backstory. But there is some really interesting stuff. And the stuff that I didn't know about had to do with Aaron Hernandez's sexual preferences, because this documentary goes pretty deep into the fact that, according to Aaron Hernandez's high school quarterback, they were lovers during high school.
Yeah.
And that... this was not just sort of a tawdry thing to bring up, but that the documentary argues that it was part and parcel of understanding where Aaron Hernandez was coming from. This was a kid who grew up in Connecticut. He had a really domineering and apparently homophobic father who then died in a routine surgery, which, you know, sort of really affected Hernandez. He was then very angry at his mother for her romantic behavior. He goes to the University of Miami and learns that if he acts out this anger, he can get away with whatever he wants. Then he decides that, you know, projecting a real macho persona, gangster persona, is not only something that, you know, he can do, but it helps hide the fact that he may be gay and that would be not accepted by his football and other peers. You throw all of that into the mix and you have a really volatile stew. And then, of course, we have a lot of talk in the documentary about CTE, which is another big factor. It's obviously a big topic whenever anyone's discussing the NFL these days. And as it turns out, Aaron Hernandez had quite severe CTE, especially for a man who was so unbelievably young when he died. I mean, he was in his mid-20s. So, you know, the documentary is, it's got a lot of material. It's got a lot of archival material. It's got a lot of people talking on camera who were intimately involved with Hernandez. And it has his prison conversations on the phone with his fiance slash wife and his other friends and lawyers. And so there's a real insight here. I'm not sure there is one answer to the Aaron Hernandez story, but I think the documentary is so good because it understands the sort of multitude of factors that, you know, when sometimes it's a multitude of factors, and when they combine, you know, unfortunately in a certain way, you get a perfect storm, and certainly that's what you had here.
Well, it sounds absolutely fascinating. I can't wait to jump into that. And I mean, some of the things you mentioned right off the bat were things that I was unaware of, even having followed that story. Finally, Nick, there's one Netflix series. Here comes another one. And this one I have particular interest in because it's called Cheer. I've got two daughters that just qualified for the national championships in Anaheim in the second week of February. And this is a topic that I've talked about on my program, that there are still individuals who like to believe cheer or cheerleading is not a sport. And I have always said, listen, I'll bring you to one of my daughter's practices and let you decide for yourself when you see the physicality and the skill involved and the focus and intensity that is in play. You're not going to see any difference than when you go to a football or basketball, hockey, and so on practice. So explain what this documentary series is about.
Well, you're totally right when it comes to cheerleading. You know, I think a lot of people, obviously people know about cheerleading from just watching, you know, professional sports and seeing the cheerleaders on the sidelines. That's one brand of cheerleading. The other brand of cheerleading, which is competitive and involves lots of tumbling and throwing and catching and pyramids, I think people are somewhat aware of because, you know, for a time it used to broadcast on ESPN and you used to see the national championships. Cheer is about the best cheerleading program in the country, which takes place, which is situated in tiny Corsicana, Texas, at a community college, Navarro Community College, where the coach has won something like 14 national championships. Wow. I mean, they are the powerhouse. And Cheer is a six-part Netflix series that follows their 2018 to 2019 season. And their attempts to once again come out on top at the championships in Daytona. As you said, cheerleading is a real sport, and if you don't believe it, you only have to watch one episode of Cheer for that to be so patently obvious that it's not up for debate. These kids are not only doing amazingly athletic things, but they are suffering amazingly horrific athletic injuries. I mean, this is not some soft and cuddly pastime. This is real athletics. I mean, these kids are hyperextending things, spraining things, breaking things all over the place, legs, arms, knees, ankles. It's really, and not to mention concussions, it is a sort of almost startling in its portrayal of how brutal the sport can be. And so on the one hand, the series is eye-opening. On another hand, the series is quite, you know, exciting and suspenseful because it is a series that is building to the championships, and we want to know whether or not they're going to win or not. But then on top of that, the third aspect is we have all these character portraits of these actual kids, and we get to sort of know them, know their hang-ups, know their troubled pasts. And we get a really sort of touching portrait of cheerleading and this cheerleading program in particular as something of a family that helps bring together damaged damaged kids and kids that are in need of things. And I think in that regard, it has a really universal aspect because it's like a lot of sports. It really does function the way a sports team does, whether it's baseball, basketball, football, fencing, what have you. This is really a portrait of the way in which sports can be a family, a support unit, a community for wayward people and just from people of all different, stripes, whether they're black or white, straight or gay. There's a real sort of inclusiveness here. And so I found it to be sort of great. And it's already become an enormous hit on Netflix just in the last few days. And, you know, people who are into sports, I mean, it really sort of has everything.
Well, I can tell you, I've learned so much from both my daughters, Kaylee and Cadence, from watching them. You know, they're coaches, there's choreographers, there's incredibly just very detailed music that, you know, tempo changes and what have you. And as I said, you know, there's the cheer part, which you talked about, you know, the pyramids and the gymnastics-esque type stuff. And there's the dance part of it. And you watch these kids, and I mean, one inch off or one little wobble, it's like gymnastics judging, where that can take you from a national championship to not even placing. There's a little bit of drama as well with the kids, as there are in sports, as there are in locker rooms. But what I found in this, more than anything, that's really been fun to watch, and I'm curious to see if we see it at all in Cheer, is these kids support each other. They're competing, but they all support each other. They get behind each other from rival schools. They, you know, they want to see everybody do well. They want to win, but they want to see others do well. And that's one of the really wonderful byproducts when you watch these young ladies and young men in Cheer at the high school level.
No, and that is absolutely a big facet of the show. You know, it's surprising almost to an extent because the team is a 40-person team and only 20 of the kids can actually get on the mat to compete at Daytona. And so there is obviously inter-team rivalry. I mean, people want to be on the mat. They don't want to be the backups. And yet the amount of support and encouragement that everyone gives everyone else was almost startling. I couldn't believe it. I certainly expected people to, you know, you think of a backup quarterback as being, yes, of course, supportive, but not, you know, hugging people and telling them that they love them and whatnot. And yet here, these fierce competitors are really still on the same page. And it's doubly sort of surprising because this is a sport in particular, cheerleading, where there is nothing after college. I mean, when they're done with college, that's it, and they all accept that. So they have 2 years, you know, here at this community college to compete for a championship, and then that's it. And, yeah, as you said, it's all riding on perfection at the performances. They've got 2.5 minutes for the year to be perfect. And if you're not perfect, you know, to some extent, that's the year. And you may not get another chance ever again in your life to compete. There's a lot of pressure. And so it is, you know, both moving and definitely, definitely thrilling.
Well, I can't wait to watch it. You and I are both fans of documentaries, and especially when something hits home like this, even better. Folks, nobody better than Nick Shager from Variety, Daily Beast, Yahoo Movies, and Esquire. Great stuff as always, my friend. And we will check in with you again next Friday.
Have a great weekend.
The Christopher Gabriel Program on 940 ESPN. Christopher Gabriel returns.
One more thing today is just to close shop and lock up and leave the building. I want to thank Derek X for joining me, Tony Landry, Nick Shager, Gonzo doing his usual great job, and all of you. Lots of stuff coming your way on the Monday program. Folks, have a great weekend. Go check out women's basketball tomorrow at Save Mart Center. That is a great team. They're in first place in the Mountain West. Folks, until Monday, you're on your own.
Smell and the sound of waves crash down. I am no Superman. I have no reason.
Your home of Fresno State football.
To Harper, a stiff arm, sending him off all the way to the goal line. Touchdown, Fresno State.
940 ESPN, KFIG, Fresno.